Tonight we'll be in the book of Deuteronomy, the 32nd chapter. If you want to turn your Bibles to Deuteronomy chapter 32, verse 48. Contextually, chapter 32 ends with verse 47 that we covered last week. They didn't ask me where to end the chapter, so I didn't have any input on it, but I think that would have been a better chapter break as we finish what was known as the Song of Moses. And it says, beginning with verse 48, that would actually, in my mind, be verse 1 of chapter 33, it says, "Then the Lord spoke to Moses that very same day, saying, 'Go up to this mountain of the Abiram, Mount Nebo, which is in the land of Moab, across from Jericho, view the land of Canaan, which I give to the children as a possession, and die.'" He says, go up to this mountain and die. That's not the period, though. It says, "And die on the mountain where which you ascend, and be gathered to your people, just as Aaron your brother died on Mount Hor and was gathered to his people." You know, you would think that Moses would say, if I'm just going to go up there and die, why don't we just do it now? Do it down here in the valley, you know, because that's a big old mountain. Why do you want me to climb it? But he says, I want to show you the land of Canaan. He says, "Because you have trespassed against me among the children of Israel at the waters of Meribah Kadesh in the wilderness of Zin, and because you didn't hallow me in the midst of the children of Israel." We know the story about how Moses had misrepresented the Lord. Said, go speak to the rock. He didn't speak to it. He struck it as he had done the first time. And God wanted to talk to Moses in his office then. And he says, "And yet you shall see the land." You can't go into the land, he says. But in verse 52, he says, "You shall see the land before you, though you shall not go there into the land that I'm giving to the children of Israel." And so while on the top of Mount Nebo, that's quite a vantage point. You can't see the entire country of Israel from there. So there was a supernatural kind of revelation that God was giving him here. Now, chapter 32, if you were here last week, it was full of a bunch of warnings and some dire prophecies where, you know, the Song of Moses, he was saying, when you get into the land and you start worshiping idols, I'm going to spank you and I'm going to carry you off into captivity. For a song, it was kind of a downer. You know, a lot of warnings but then chapter 33, as we turn to 33, it's 100% blessings. It's all positive. And I think that we can look at chapter 32 as not that one. I don't even know what that is. That's not the right slide. That's what it is. Never mind. We can look at chapter 33, or chapter 32, and that's looking back at the temporal life, the life that we have under the sun, full of all of its failures, all of its shortcomings, all of its trials and testings. That's chapter 32, all of its warnings and all of its dire predictions. That's life under the sun. Chapter 33 is like after the grave, the next life. It's looking at life from eternity's perspective. It's kind of like in the book of Hebrews, when we read some of the stories in Hebrews chapter 11, where it talks about by faith these guys did that, and by faith these guys did this thing over here. And we read the story in Hebrews, and it doesn't quite line up with the story that we have in the Old Testament. It talks about guys like, by faith, Barak, you know, and when we go back and read the story of Barak in the book of Judges, we think he wasn't so faithful. But the book of Judges has given us the story from the perspective of this life here on earth, with all of our pros and cons and victories and failures, where the book of Hebrews is looking at it from heaven's perspective, from eternity's perspective. Chapter 32 looks at life as it is now. Chapter 33 looks at the life that is to come, how God sees us in our position. And it's going to be very reminiscent, if you're familiar with Jacob, in the closing chapters of Genesis, chapters 48 and 49, when he calls all of the sons together on his deathbed and gives them blessings. You'll see that chapter 33 has a lot in common with that. It says, "Now this is the blessing with which Moses, the man of God, blessed the children of Israel before his death. And he said, 'The Lord came down from Sinai and dawned on them from Seir, and he shone forth from the mountain, from Mount Paran, and he gave 10,000s of saints from his right hand, and came a fiery law for them.'" These three mountain peaks that he mentions, and I guess they are on here. You got Mount Sinai, with traditional location down at the southern tip of the Sinai Peninsula. Then you got Mount Paran and Mount Seir. These are the three main mountain peaks that dealt with various events of the children of Israel when they were wandering in the wilderness. And he kind of reminisces those. He brings those back to mind here. And he says, through it all, it wasn't just like I gave you these 10 tablets while you were there at Sinai and then said, okay, now go make nice. He was with them throughout their entire journey. His law was with them, as he says. From the time that I revealed myself at Mount Sinai, clear up until you left the wilderness to cross over the Jordan. And he says, yes, verse 3, he loves the people. All his saints are in your hand, and they sit down at your feet, and everyone receives your words. Moses commanded a law for us, a heritage of the congregation of Jacob. And he was king in Jeshurun. We saw that last week, which means it's God's pet name for Israel. It means upright one. And he says he was king in Jeshurun when the leaders of the people were gathered and all the tribes of Israel together. Reuben, let Reuben live and not die, nor let his men be few. Now, if you notice, if you got the New King James as I do tonight, you notice in verse 6 where it says, let Reuben live and not die, nor let his men be few. You see the word nor there is in italics. Some of the translations, some of the English translations will show italicized words. And what that means is when the guys are translating the Bible from Hebrew and Greek into English, sometimes you have to, it helps if you add a word here or there to kind of make it smoother, you know, so it just, it's a little more fluid in the reading. It's not so wooden sounding. And whenever they add a word, they always put it in italics. The New King James, Old King James, New American Standard do this. And they show it, they put it in italics so that we can know that that's added by the translators. It's not in the original text. Typically, these added words don't change the meaning. They just kind of make it read a little smoother. Now, I don't know how you can add the word nor or take the word nor out. I don't see how that's optional as to whether or not it's going to change the meaning. You know, if you say, let Reuben live and not die, nor let his men be few, or take the word out and say, let Reuben live and not die, let his men be few. It sounds like it's saying just the opposite. The New Living Translation renders it this way, and that's not it. I don't even know why that's in there. That's not supposed to be in there. Okay, let's go on past this and see if it comes up here. Nope. I don't know what the deal is. But the New Living Translation says, let the tribe of Reuben live and not die out, though they are few in number. And I think what the idea here, what's being communicated, Reuben was one of the Transjordan tribes. Remember, there were the 2.5 tribes that stayed on the eastern side of the Jordan. Up until this point, up until the time that the nation becomes a nation, Reuben was one of the main tribes. Reuben was one of the main sons. And this was a very dominant tribe. But because they never entered into the land with the other tribes, they never were major players when we came into the land. And I think that it's saying, you know, let Reuben live and not die. And don't let him die out, but he's not going to be a major player. And this he said of Judah, hear the Lord, the voice of Judah, and bring him to his people. Let his hands be sufficient for him, and may you be a help against his enemies. You know, Judah was the main military force of all the 10 tribes. In fact, there were times when they were the army. You know, when the nations divided, it was basically the tribe of Judah against all the other tribes. And so he's saying, they're going to be sufficient to get the job done. And then verse 8 of Levi, he said, let your Thummim and your Urim be with your Holy One, whom you tested at Massah, with whom you contended at the waters of Meribah, who says of his father and mother, I have not seen them, nor did he acknowledge his brothers or know his own children, for they have observed your word and kept your covenant. They shall teach Jacob your judgments and Israel your law, and they shall put incense before you and a whole burnt sacrifice at your altar. Bless his substance, Lord. Bless Levite's substance. Accept the work of his hands and strike the loins of those who rise against him and of those who hate him, that they rise not again. Now, usually, you know, we've seen the Urim and the Thummim many times in the Pentateuch, in the books of Moses, and this was part of the law. They were probably these two colored stones. One was white and one was black, and it was kept inside the breastplate of the high priest. They would use the Urim and the Thummim to discern the Lord's will. They would probably ask, it seems like whenever they're consulted in the Old Testament, it would be that they were wanting to know a yes or no kind of a question from the Lord. Should we go forward or should we not? and the priest would reach into his breastplate and pull out one of the rocks. We're never told exactly how they work, but it's generally considered that they would reach in and grab a rock, and then if it was a white one, it meant yes, and if it was a black one, it meant no, or something along those lines. And every time they're mentioned in the Old Testament, they're always given to us as the Urim and the Thummim, except here. They're given to us as the Thummim and the Urim. I don't know if they're just trying to confuse us or what it is, but this is what this is referring to is back after God had given Moses the Ten Commandments. And Moses and Joshua are walking back down the mountain, and he's got the Ten Commandments under his arm, and they hear this big noise down in the camp. And Joshua says, "Look, Lord, there's a battle," or Moses, "there's a battle of, there sounds like the sound of war going on down there." And Moses says, "No, that ain't no war. That's a party. That sounds like they got a rave going on." And so he goes down, and that's what was happening. They were having a party, and they had made this golden calf, and they were worshiping it and dancing around it and everything. And when Moses threw down the Ten Commandments, and he said, "All of you that are on the Lord's side, stand over here, and all of you that are not, stand over there." And the tribe of Levi all sided with the Lord. And this is hearkening back to that. It's given to us in Exodus chapter 32. And because of that, they were made the priestly tribe. Of Benjamin, he says in verse 12, "The beloved of the Lord shall dwell safely by him who shelters him all the day long, and he shall dwell between his shoulders." You notice that he, meaning Benjamin, shall dwell between his, capital H, meaning the Lord's, shoulders. Now that's pretty security. You don't get any more secure than dwelling between the Lord's shoulders, does it? And Benjamin was with Judah when the nations divided after Solomon's death, and Jeroboam took the 10 tribes and went off and started their own country. Benjamin stayed faithful to Judah and Jerusalem and the temple. And because of that, he says they will dwell securely. He kept them between his shoulders, he says. And of Joseph, he said, "Blessed is the Lord in his hand, with the precious things of heaven, with the dew, and with the deep lying beneath, with the precious fruits of the sun, the precious produce of the months, with the best things of the ancient mountains, with the precious things of the everlasting hills, with the precious things of the earth in its fullness, and the favor of him who dwelt in the bush." Hearkening back to Exodus when God spoke to Moses out of the burning bush. "And let the blessing come on the head of Joseph, and on the crown of him, of the head of him who was separate from his brothers. His glory is like a firstborn bull, and his horns like the horns of a wild ox. Together with them he shall push the peoples to the ends of the earth. They are like the 10,000s of Ephraim, and they are the thousands of Manasseh." So he says, blessed is Joseph. Now, if you remember, we've seen this, we looked at this last week as well, many other times previously. Joseph, when Jacob was giving the blessings of the 12 sons in Genesis 48 and 49, Joseph said, "Look, I'm the number two guy in the world. I got more than enough for anybody. So let me give my inheritance to my sons." And he basically gave his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, to Jacob as adopted sons. And so Jacob reached out to bless Manasseh, who was Joseph's firstborn, and Joseph took his hand and moved it over to Manasseh, or Ephraim instead. And Jacob he said, "No, that's not right. Ephraim's the secondborn. I'm supposed to bless the firstborn first." And he started to move his hand back to Manasseh, and Joseph corrected him and said, "No, I want you to bless Ephraim." And so he did, and in essence, Ephraim received the rights of the firstborn of Jacob's two sons in that process. And it says here, these are the thousands of Ephraim, or the 10,000s of Ephraim, and then he says only the thousands of Manasseh. So even though Manasseh was Joseph's firstborn, Ephraim was the one that received the double portion, received the blessing. And Ephraim, in fact, Ephraim in many cases is used synonymously for all of the 10 northern tribes. Sometimes it's called the country of nation of Ephraim because they were the most dominant tribe. And of Zebulun, verse 18, he said, "Rejoice, Zebulun, in your going out, and Issachar in your tents. They shall call the peoples to the mountain, and they shall offer sacrifices of righteousness, for they shall partake of the abundance of the seas and of the treasures hidden in the sand." And of Gad, he said, "Blessed is he who enlarges Gad. He dwells as a lion and tears the arm of the crown of his head. He provided the first part for himself because a lawgiver's portion was reserved here, and he came with the heads of the people and administered the justice of the Lord and his just judgments with Israel. And then of Dan he said, Dan is a lion's whelp, and he shall leap from Bashan. Now, if you look at a Bible map, if you open up the back of your Bible, you see a Bible map that shows the 12 tribes of Israel. You notice that originally Dan was the allocation that was given to him, his parcel of land, was kind of in the middle part of the country on the Mediterranean shore. And that's where his original allotment was given. But there was during the book of Judges, they decided that they weren't going to settle for that parcel of land. And they discovered this place up to the northeast of the Sea of Galilee, up in the foothills of the Golan Heights, that was very lush, very green, and there was a city there by the name of Laish that was very unprotected. And they said, let's just go move up there. I know God gave us this one, but we would rather have something else. And so they went up to this more verdant, more prosperous looking area than what they had on the Mediterranean, thinking that it was a good move for them. And financially, it probably was. Financially, it was very lush garden lands. It was very rich pasture lands. They prospered very materially. But they were also the first tribe to fall in. They were on the very edge. It was kind of like the far northeast of the nation, like where the state of Maine, just right on the very edge of the country. And they were the very first ones to fall into idolatry because they were kind of separated from the rest of the nation. They were also the very first ones to fall into captivity because they were so unprotected. He says, he's like a lion's whelp, and he shall leap from Bashan. It's right in the area of Bashan, very great pasture land. Rather than being in the mid-coastal area, they went up to the northeast. Of Naphtali, he says in verse 23, he said, O Naphtali, satisfied with favor and full of the blessing of the Lord, possess the west and the south. Naphtali was located to the west and to the south of the Sea of Galilee. Again, a very rich, fertile, it's part of the Jezreel Valley is there, the Valley of Megiddo. It's a very rich, verdant, green, lush area. Beautiful part of the nation. It's satisfied with favor, as Moses says. And of Asher, verse 24, he said, Asher is the most blessed of sons. Let him be favored by his brothers, and let him dip his foot in oil. Now, I can remember as a young believer back in the early 80s, I was watching Christian television talk show one time, and they had this guy on there. He was an oil speculator, and he was a Christian. And he had ran across this verse where he says, let him dip his foot in his toe in oil. And he said, if you look at a map of Asher, you'll see that it's kind of shaped like a foot. And if you look down at the very tip of it where the toe would be, he says, I believe this is a prophecy from God of some hidden oil reserves. He's going to dip his toe in oil. And so they started this massive wildcatting throughout that whole area, hoping that one day they would strike oil. They didn't. I don't think this is talking about Texas tea. I don't think this prophecy would have done them any good in those days to think that they would have found oil. It was a prophecy about olive oil. Now, they have found some very rich natural gas preserves in that area since then, but I don't think that's what this verse is talking about. It's talking about olive oil. He says, your sandals shall be bronze, iron and bronze, as your days, so shall your strength be. Now, this verse didn't have the meaning to me in earlier times. As I've gone through the Bible many times over my years as a Christian, it's got a lot more meaning to me today than it used to have. Where he says, and as your days, so shall your strength be. As I get older, and I start feeling some of the aches and the pains and some of the lack of vim and vigor that I had as a younger man, I'm thinking, you know, that's a pretty cool blessing. To have, as long as your days are, so shall your strength be. In other words, his prayer, prophecy, if you will, concerning Asher, is that you're going to rock until you drop. You know, you're going to keep going, you're going to keep going, you're not going to have any lack of strength and virility until your days are up. And what a way to go. You know, to be able to serve the Lord with all you've got, there's no physical restraints, nothing that holds you back, and you're doing that until the day he calls you home. That's a pretty awesome blessing. He says, there is no one like the God of Jeshurun, who rides the heavens to help you, and in his excellency on the clouds. You know, there's no one like the God of Jeshurun, who rides the heavens to help you. I mean, get a picture of God hanging 10 in the heavens. You know, it's kind of what's being described here. Hanging 10 on a cloud as he goes through the heavens. The eternal God is your refuge, and underneath are the everlasting arms. And he will thrust out the enemy from before you and will say, destroy. Now, here in verse 27, it says, the eternal God is your refuge, and underneath are the everlasting arms. The word eternal here in the original language is not the normal Hebrew word for eternal or everlasting. The word everlasting is, where he says everlasting arms, that's the word olam. And that would be the normal Hebrew word for eternal. That's not the word that he uses here. In fact, the word that he uses for the eternal God is your refuge, that word eternal is actually the word for east. It means just, you know, like in English we have the word orient, which means the east. And it comes from an old Latin word which means to rise. And then it, you know, kind of came through the Latin and the French, and the idea is the rising sun. And today we say, you know, I've got to get myself oriented, which means, you know, okay, we find out which way east is, and then we can know where we stand. We can figure out our directions that way. And that today when you get a new job or you go to a new school, they give you an orientation. And that comes from the word east. It means to get your bearings and to, you know, to get your legs under you. That's the same idea here in this Hebrew word. The everlasting God, the eternal God, it uses the word east here because, you know, when the sun rises up in the morning, that's a new day, right? The night is over and you got this new day, and it's this idea of, okay, we got this fresh start. It's a new beginning. The dark is gone and now it's light, and we can start all over again. That's the idea here, that God is this God of new beginnings. As we orientate ourselves to the east and we see the sunrise, and God is saying, you know, let's start over. Let's have a new beginning here. Verse 28, then Israel shall dwell in safety, and the fountains of Jacob alone in the land of grain and new wine. His heavens shall also drop dew. Happy are you, O Israel, and who is like you, O people saved by the Lord? The shield of your help, the sword of your majesty, your enemies shall submit to you, and you shall tread down their high places. So this whole chapter 33, is nothing but blessings. It's asking prosperity upon the nation. It's praying that God would bless and prosper the nation as they embark on this new endeavor of building a country. And as we saw last week, the book of Deuteronomy was written by Moses. Okay, I know a lot of Bible scholars try to debate that, and they try to come up with all different ideas and views about, there's the documentary hypothesis and all these different things, trying to determine the author of Moses. And we saw last week, it says Moses wrote it. You know, the Bible tells us who wrote it. But chapter 34 is a description of Moses' death, probably not written by Moses. You know, I think he probably wrote the other 33 chapters, but this last chapter was probably added on later. Most of the Bible guys believe it was probably Joshua. That's probably a safe bet. But it was somebody that just kind of tacked on the ending. You know, we end with chapter 33, and okay, there's this blessing, but now what? And so chapter 34 is going to tell us about the death and burial of Moses. It was probably written, as I said, by Joshua or maybe one of the priests at the end of the conquest, you know, chronologically around the end of the book of Joshua. And it says, then Moses went up from the plains of Moab to Mount Nebo to the top of Pisgah, which is across from Jericho. And the Lord showed him all the land of Gilead as far as Dan. That's about 100 miles to the north, this land of Dan that was up at Caesarea Philippi, up in that area of Laish. It's a long way. You wouldn't have been, even on a clear day, you wouldn't have been able to see that from Mount Nebo. So there was probably some supernatural vision that was going on here. He says that he went up there to the top of Pisgah, which is across from Jericho, and the Lord showed him all of the land of Gilead as far as Dan, all Naphtali, the land of Ephraim, all of Manasseh, all of the land of Judah as far as the western sea, which would be the Mediterranean, the south, which would be the Negev down in the Sinai, or the down around Beersheba and all the way down to the Gulf. The plain of the Valley of Jericho, which was right in front of them. They could have seen that pretty easily. The city of palm trees as far as Zoar. And then the Lord said to him, "This is the land of which I swore to give Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, saying, I will give it to your descendants. I have caused you to see it with your eyes, but you shall not cross over there." I can remember as a child in Sunday school and coming to this point of the story, after reading about how faithful Moses had been, how he had just put up for 120 years, he had lived, at least for the last 80 of them, he had lived lives of a life of hardship. And he had a lot of sufferings. He had put up with a lot of snotting and sniveling from the Israelites. And as it says in the book of Hebrews, he had been faithful with all of his house. And he had done so well. He had towed the line. He had kept his eyes on God. He had been so faithful through it all. God had done such mighty, wonderful works through his hands. And then there was this one little hiccup, this one little speed bump where he stubbed his toe one time toward the end, where God said, "Go speak to the rock," and he struck the rock instead. And even took it upon himself and he said, "Must we bring water out of this rock?" And because of that failure, because of that one just momentary little stutter step, God didn't let him go into the nation. He couldn't cross over into the land. And I remember as a kid thinking, "I'm not sure this is really fair, God. I'm not really sure. This doesn't really sound like it was the right thing for Moses." But Moses did get to go to the promised land. We see a couple of examples in the New Testament. In Matthew chapter 17, right after Jesus had asked the disciples, "Who do the people say I am?" And Peter had given his great profession of faith, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God, and blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for man didn't show that to you, but my Father in heaven did." And then right after that, Jesus began to tell them about how he was going to go to Jerusalem and die, and Peter called him off to the side and he says, "Lord, far be it from you. That shall never happen to you." And Jesus, remember his response, "Get thee behind me, Satan. For you are mindful of the things of man, not the things of God." The very next story, we turn the page of the Bible and we find ourselves in Matthew 17, where Jesus says, "Now after 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John, his brother, and led them up on a high mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun. His clothes became as white as light. And behold, Moses and Elijah appeared to them, talking with them." So here we have in the book of Matthew, chapter 17, we have Moses and Elijah both standing there appearing before Jesus in the New Testament. So Moses did get to go to the New Testament, or get to go to the Promised Land. In fact, in the book of Revelation, in chapter 11, we have the story of the two witnesses in Jerusalem during the tribulation period, where these two witnesses that are testifying to the Lord. They're unidentified. It's pretty inarguable that one of the guys is Elijah. I am of the persuasion that the other one is Moses, that it's Moses and Elijah, the law and the prophets, testifying to the glory of the Lord. Now, some people disagree with that, and they would say it's Moses and Enoch. I don't argue with them. If they do, I just say they're wrong, but I don't argue with them because I think it's Moses and Elijah. So he did get to go to the promised land. But even more importantly than that, we can say, "Oh, that's metaphorical," or "That's figurative," and all that. What's really significant about it, if we were to have Moses stand before us tonight, if Mo himself could come up here, and we were to ask him, "How do you feel that you weren't able to cross over with the people after all those years?" He would say, "What are you talking about? You worried about me? You worried about my lack? You worried about something that you think I am? I am short. I'm not lacking anything." God is just in all of his doings, Moses would tell us. And so Moses, verse 5, the servant of the Lord died there in the land of Moab, according to the word of the Lord. And he, capital H, God, buried him in a valley in the land of Moab, opposite Beth Peor, but no one knows his grave to this day. I wonder why that is. I mean, you can go to Jerusalem, you can see the tomb of David. There's tombs all over the nation of Israel. You can go to the tomb of Rebecca. You can go to the tomb of Rachel. All these places. Why do we not know where the tomb of Moses is? Well, if you were to go to the tomb of David or the tomb of Rebecca or the tomb of Rachel or any of those other tombs that they have there in Israel today, you would know why we don't know where Moses is. Because we would, knowing people, we would build the biggest honking shrine you'd ever seen before. And people would be bowing down and worshiping this shrine. And so the Bible says that God himself buried Moses so that nobody would know where he was. The rabbis say that he sent angels to come and bury him there up in the mountains. And it says in verse 7 that Moses was 120 years old when he died. And his eyes were not dim, nor his natural vigor diminished. You know, he had 20/20 vision. And all the rest of his body worked too at 120. It's pretty amazing. And the children of Israel wept for Moses in the plains of Moab 30 days. And so the days of weeping and mourning for Moses died. There may be some things about this part of the story that I can't explain. There's some blanks here that I don't quite know how to fill in about Moses and why it ends this way. And what I always do when I find myself in places of the Bible that I don't know, I fall back on what I do. If there's things that I can't answer, I always revert back to the things that I can. And one thing I know is that Moses had no regrets. He had no regrets. Even as he was to look back, not on the end, but even more significantly, if he were to look back on his life, he would have no regrets. Now, when I say that, that doesn't mean that if he had the opportunity to do things differently, he wouldn't. You know, who of us wouldn't do that? You know, if we had the chance to redo some things, if we had some mulligans in life, you know, how many of us wouldn't take that? I'm sure Moses would take that opportunity if he could redo the speaking to the rock scene. You know, he would love to do that again. But that's not what I mean when I say he has no regrets. When I say that Moses would look back on his life and he would have no regrets, what I mean by that is that there was nothing left undone. You know, that whatever mistakes, whatever failures he might have had in his life, he had dealt with them. And there was nothing left undone. Not that he wouldn't do things differently, but he had no regrets on how he had lived his life, how he had dealt with his mistakes. You know, this last week we celebrated, just a couple days ago, we celebrated Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. And I was watching a documentary on him the other day, and it was talking about, you know, he had several of his speeches that had become very famous over the decades. And there was one that he gave. It was on April 3rd, 1968. And it was his "I've Been to the Mountain" speech. And he starts off, he's telling the story about on December 20th, 1958, he was at a book signing in Harlem after he'd written his first book back in 58. And he was sitting there at the table signing books, and this elderly lady came up with a 7-inch letter opener and stabbed him in the chest. And he was rushed to the emergency room there at the hospital there in Harlem, and this letter opener had stuck into his chest and was right up against his aorta. And the New York Times, the next day, as they were reporting the story, they said if he had sneezed, he would have died. And he says he got, you know, telegrams and cards and letters from all over the world wishing him well as he was recovering. And he says, I don't remember any of them really, except there was this one card that I got from a ninth grade girl from White Plains, New York. And she said, "Dear Dr. King, I heard that if you'd sneezed, you would have died. I read in the paper that if you'd sneezed, you would have died. I'm so glad you didn't sneeze." And he said, "I too am very happy that I didn't sneeze." And then he went on to kind of recount all of the things that he had experienced in the last decade, in the 10 years from 1958 to 1968, of the advancements in the civil rights movement, and all the different experiences that he'd had. If I'd have sneezed, I would have missed this. If I'd have sneezed, I would have missed that. And then he says, well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead, but it really doesn't matter with me now because I've been to the mountaintop. I'm not going to try to say it like Dr. King did. And I don't mind. Like anybody, I'd like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. He's allowed me to go up to the mountain, and I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. I'm so happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. April 3rd, 1968. April 4th, 1968, he was assassinated. Now, he might not have had the theology of the promised land down pat, but I think this is a guy that had his eyes on eternity. Did he make mistakes in his life? Of course. Were there things that he would have done differently if he'd had the opportunity to go back and get a mulligan? Well, yeah. But nothing had been left undone because he had an eternal focus. He had his eyes on the Lord. I don't know if you know who Frank Pastore was. He was a Major League Baseball player in the 70s and 80s. And played primarily for the Cincinnati Reds, and became a Christian. He had an injury where he got hit by on the elbow by a line drive, and it essentially ruined his career. And while he was rehabilitating over that, he came to the Lord, became a member of Calvary Chapel, Chino Valley, and also he on KKLA radio and there in Los Angeles, he had one of the number one Christian talk radio programs in the world in the country. Frank Pastore. On November 19th, 2012, he was talking, and they were talking about life after death and that sort of thing on the program. And he says this, I mean, look, you guys know I ride a motorcycle, don't you? So if at any moment, especially with the idiot people who cross the diamond lane into my lane, all right, without any blinkers, I'm not angry about that, but at any moment, I could be spread out all over the 210. But that's not me. That's my body parts. And the key distinction undergirds the entire Judeo-Christian worldview and also our pursuit of reality. And then he goes on to say, don't worry about me. My soul is doing fine somewhere, gorging on steaks the size of galaxies. Well, 3 hours later, as he left the radio station and got on his Honda to go home, a lady in a Hyundai Sonata crossed over into his lane. He had a motorcycle wreck, and he ended up dying. It was several weeks later, but he died from the brain injuries. Now, Frank Pastore was a man of flesh. He was a man of bones and sinews and blood and skin, just like we are. But he lived his life in light of eternity. He lived his life in such a way that there were no regrets. Not that he wouldn't do things differently, but he left nothing undone. And when his day came, he was ready. Just like Martin Luther King Jr.'s, just like Moses. It says in verse 6, now Joshua, the son of Nun, was full of the spirit of wisdom, for Moses had laid his hands on him. So the children of Israel heeded him and did as the Lord had commanded Moses. And since then, there has not arisen in Israel a prophet like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face. From the time of the writing of Deuteronomy chapter 34, whenever that was, at the end of Joshua's life or whenever, from that time, the author here says that there since Moses until now, there hasn't been anyone like Moses. We know that Moses prophesied that there in chapter 18, if you remember that, he said, there will become a prophet after me, you know, referring to Jesus. But at this point, there had been no prophet like Moses, says, whom the Lord knew face to face. Literally, that phrase, face to face, literally it means mouth to mouth. He's talking about that kind of, that the Lord had that kind of intimacy with him, that they were just like this, right in front of each other, that they spoke, God spoke to Moses as one does to a friend. and all the signs and the wonders which the Lord sent him to do in the land of Egypt before Pharaoh and before all his servants and all his land, and by all that mighty power and all that great terror which the Lord performed in the sight of all Israel. You know, the Bible is replete with examples like Moses. I mean, we got David, the shepherd king. I got Daniel, the one individual in all of the Bible outside of Jesus of whom there's no faults given. There's no shortcomings given to us in Scripture about Daniel. I'm sure he was a sinner, just like the rest of us, but they're not recorded in Scripture. In the New Testament, we've got the apostles Paul and Peter and the rest of them. I mean, these guys were mighty, awesome, standout men of God. Miracles were performed through their hands. Great and awesome examples, just like Moses. But for every Abraham and Isaiah that we have in Scripture, we also have an Ebed-Melech. Remember Ebed-Melech? He was the Ethiopian that came and rescued Jeremiah when he was thrown down into the pit. And he pleaded his case before the king and got him rescued out of the cistern. For every one of these great, awesome, mighty men of faith, for every Jeremiah that we have in the Bible, we've got a Sylvanus or a Tychicus that Paul just references almost in passing in his letters. And the only thing he says about them is that they were faithful to what God had given them. That they were faithful to what God had entrusted to them. They were faithful to their stewardship. They were just simply faithful. As I said, Hebrews chapter 3 tells us that Moses was faithful in all of his house. How was he faithful? Well, I think two things we can say about Moses and his faithfulness. One is he obeyed the Lord. And secondly, that he took every situation, every circumstance, everything that he encountered in his life after he found the Lord, after his encounter with the Lord, from that time forward, every speed bump, every obstacle, every problem, everything that he encountered in the Lord, he laid before his face. And he said, here, Lord, this is your problem, not mine. He was able to take the fact that he had over 1 million people that were complaining about not having any water, and he says, God, these people need water. What are you going to do about it? It wasn't his problem, it was the Lord's problem. He was able to put the situations in God's hands and then just trust him for the outcome. That's how he was faithful to all of his house. We're called to nothing less. In the same way, I mean, we don't have to part seas with our staves. We don't have to be able to bring water from a rock. We just have to be faithful in all our house, in walking in obedience to him, and then trusting our lives in his care. God, we thank you for that calling. We thank you for that charge that you've given to each one of us. You have given us everything that we need for life and godliness. God, you have equipped us for faithfulness. And oh yeah, it's easy for us to look back at our failures and look back at our mistakes. And God, it's easy for us to wish we could do things over. But that's not as important as living with no regrets. That's not as important as leaving nothing undone. And the same spirit that equips us, the same spirit that enables us, is that same spirit that gives us that rising sun every morning where your mercies are new and we have that fresh beginning to live lives of faithfulness. God, we praise you. We thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.